Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome, listeners, to a special bonus episode of The Extra Inch. My name's Windy, and I'm joined by a man you may know as Thelonious Phil from the Fighting Cock podcast, but to me, he's just my good friend, T. Hey, how are you doing, T?
Not bad, mate, not me. Good to finally make it on The Extra Inch.
Making your debut.
Yeah, we've been good under better circumstances, but we are where we are.
Indeed, indeed. How are you doing? How's lockdown been for you?
It's been good. Spent a lot of time with my family, but, you know, as we spoke about before the call, when you work from home, you normally, you know, in your boxes and you're by yourself in a house, and you're a man of leisure, but this occasion I'm in a house of, you know, three or four other people milling about, so it's very, very different, but... No, lockdown's been great, but I'm kind of gagging for it to be lifted.
A bit of normality.
Yes, yes, yes.
And obviously, lockdown is hard enough for everyone as it is, but how did the murder of George Floyd and the subsequent events in the States and here impact on you?
Oh, it's been unprecedented. I don't know if the lockdown has kind of amplified things a bit, because usually you'll have a game of football to take your mind off it, or you know, a boxing match or some other event. But everything is honed in on what's happened to George Floyd and the aftermath. But, you know, I think a lot of black people are just very pessimistic. You know, when these things happen, oh, it's happening again, whatever, we'll forget about them in a week when the hashtag is no longer trending. But, you know, the aftermath has been expected. I think black people are just very, you know, just tired of it, really. And, you know, it's had a bit of an effect on my mental health. You know, people putting, you know, videos up and people being devil's advocate, quote unquote, to talk about the life that George Floyd led. And it's been a very surreal 2 weeks.
I can imagine. I mean, you've pointed me in the past in the direction of lots of reading materials and listening materials. And I mean, quite frankly, you've helped educate me in the history of, for want of a better phrase, black history and structural racism. Mm-hmm. And that's been hugely appreciated. But that must be pretty exhausting to have to constantly be trying to kind of pass materials onto white people and allow them to understand what black people see.
Yeah, it can be. It does almost feel like the onus is almost on black people when it should maybe be the other way around. But you know, sometimes I just put the crumbs out there, you know, for want of a better term, to kind of lead people in the right direction. There are people who want to learn more and want to understand more about racism. And I guess there's some people, as you've seen from the scenes over the weekend in the, Antifa protest? What do you even call that? The Churchill protests.
Yeah, it was the protecting the statues was what it was presented as, but I mean, we know it to be far more insidious than that.
Yeah, so, you know, if I gave them the Rennie Edo Lodge book, where I'm no longer speaking to white people about race, they'd, you know, probably spit in my face. But there's a lot of people who are receptive and want to educate themselves. So, you know, it's a mixed bag and it is exhausting. But this time does feel a bit different. It does feel like, you know, there are going to be some changes, maybe not the sea change that we all want, but there will be enough changes. For example, there's a push to have, you know, colonialism be properly spoken about in schools. Mm-hmm. Be parts of, you know, maybe black history to be part of normal history, so to speak. So, you know, these things are gaining traction and it would be good. I think it's important to know the full story when talking about the history of England, you know, the warts and all.
I think that's a really good point, and I want to come back to that. But if we can just go back briefly to the impact this has had on your mental health and the mental health of a lot of Black people. I mean, it's not just you suffering, T. It's no. I mean, this must be rife amongst other Black people that you know. Other Black people I know are suffering. Why is that? What do you know? What it is that's triggered kind of these feelings in you?
Just feels helpless. It feels like, you know, it's happened again, and it keeps happening. And yes, you know, people are saying Black Lives Matter, which is a slogan, and they say no, all lives matter. But you know, we've seen enough analogies to last a lifetime over the last week about a burning house or broken bones, and not all bones matter, not all houses matter. And they're still not seeing it. And you know, you go on, I mean, I've had to delete the Twitter app from my phone because you just be idly scrolling through and you just see someone that just kind of ruins your day. You know, whether it was, I don't know, George Floyd beat up a pregnant woman and he was subsequently imprisoned. He was high on, I think it was fentanyl or meth, not sure if they're the same thing at the time when he died. So you're reading all these comments and saying, well, you know, maybe you deserve to die. And I'm just like, you know, what the fuck is that about? You know, and then you got this thing called the George Floyd Challenge, where people are reenacting their knee on someone's neck. You know, so that's also triggering. And just people just not wanting to get it, that racism exists and it's real. And there is no such thing as a race card, you know. And it does feel like you're banging your head against a brick wall at times.
Talk to me about that more. So when you say there's no such thing as a race card, what you're saying there, I assume, is that people use that as a defence mechanism, and actually it's a way of them refusing to accept what's in front of their eyes.
Well, yeah, it's a term I've used in a lot of the last week and a half, 2 weeks, which is, you know, gaslighting. I mean, I didn't know what the term meant in full till a week ago. But that's a lot. That's you know, what happens a lot of the time, where, you know, Black people will say, look, you know, there's racism, it exists, you know, it stops us from doing this, that and the other. And they say, no, well, you're just playing the race card. Why do you work hard like everyone else does? And, you know, the structures that are in place make it difficult for Black people to get by. That's not, obviously, it's not a catch-all case. I mean, we're going to speak about football as an industry in itself, but there are some people in the football who push through, but there's still so much more that needs to be done. So like, I don't want to speak about race sometimes because I feel like people feel I'm just going to go on and on about the same things the whole time. And that kind of has an effect on me. If you're unwell and you're telling people that you're unwell, at times of time they're saying you're not sick. You're not sick. There's nothing wrong with you. You do this all the time and you're clearly suffering. That's going to affect your mental health in some way. And I think about that as your race, which, you know, current technology, you can't change your race. So, you know what I mean? It's not something that I can't just stop being Black for a day and just live, you know, live a normal life.
I mean, that puts it into some serious perspective. If every day you're having to kind of stop yourself saying things that you want to say because you fear the impact it will have on other people and the impact that that will subsequently have on you, that must be really difficult. I mean, I can't even imagine not feeling free to express myself in that way.
I mean, sorry to cut you, but there's this page on Instagram. I think it's called A Safe Space. I mean, I'll probably put it in the bio after the pod. And it's about Black people anonymously submitting experiences that have happened to them at work.
Okay.
And I think one Black lady, I mean, a lot of Black women go through this, you know, Black women really do have it tough. And, you know, she had her hair done and she was just really anxious the night before in the morning of going into work, because she knew it was going to be the subject of conversation and people are going to take the piss and try and touch her hair and ask stupid questions. And, you know, when you go into work, you just want to get on with it. You don't want to be talking about your hair or, you know, if it's your hair, how much did it cost? You know, it's just simple little things like that, really.
Stuff that white people just would not appreciate at all.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we all have a level of privilege. I've got a level of privilege as a straight male. And there's some things I don't think about, you know, when you're going out late at night and I'm walking the streets and women go through an awful lot. You know, trans people, gay, they all go through an awful lot, but you don't think about your own privilege day in, day out. So when people hear the word privilege, they think, oh, that must mean that they've got, you know, living life with a silver spoon. But it's not that at all, really.
No, and that's the section of the Edda Lodge book that I really enjoyed, the sort of section about intersectionality.
Yes, yes.
And how different people are negatively affected in multiple different ways, depending on, like you say, orientation, gender, and race. And it's you're right to say that to some degree you have privilege and you recognise that, but I mean, it's nothing compared to my privilege, for example. Yeah. And this book has really opened my eyes to that. really opened my eyes to it. I mean, it's blown it wide open for me, to be honest, and just completely changed my perspective on all of this. So let's go on to the Black Lives Matter movement. And this movement's been around for a while, and I'm sure that the outpourings of support and equally the outpourings of dissent are nothing new to you, as they're not to me. But have you ever known the movement create a wave of attention and also tension like this?
No, these are unprecedented times. People are donating millions to them at the moment, and I've not seen an outpouring like it. But you know, with every movement, there's always dissent. I mean, the dissent is from black people as well, wondering where all the money's going. What's their manifesto? What are they going to do? They've been pretty quiet from what I've seen. Maybe there are articles out there where they put out a statement and a manifesto of what they want to happen. But it's all happened very quickly for them, really. I mean, just reading up on how they started, and it was in response to the Trayvon Martin murder, which was 7 years ago. It feels like it was yesterday.
Wow.
But I think the event of the last 2 weeks has just been insane. It must be insane for them as well.
Yeah, and I think the point you made there about not knowing where the money's going, I don't necessarily think that's a concern, because like Killer Mike said in that speech, which is now famous, that impromptu speech he gave, it's time to take stock and really think and plan strategically about how we start to address some of these inequalities. And so if the organization wants to really think how that money is best spent, then I think that seems like a very sensible thing to do, to take some time.
Yeah, of course. It's just that it's been a couple of weeks and it's almost like a faceless organization. So that's a dissent that people have. If people do want to donate money, I would say donate to Black Lives Matter locally. So the majority of our listeners are from the UK. So I guess donate to Black Lives Matter UK, I'd say, more than the bigger movement. And just find local things to donate your money to, really.
What does the movement mean to you, T?
Fuck, it's difficult, really. I guess what it means to me is that, our lives are as valuable as anyone else's. And it's not about lives being any more valuable than anyone else's. This feels like when black people die, it means nothing. I mean, just last night, a black guy was murdered in Atlanta. He was asleep in his car in a drive-thru, and cars had to drive around him in a drive-thru. The police came, tried to wake him up. I think he failed a sobriety test. They tried to apprehend him. I think he tried to run away. He moved the taser, ran away, and they shot him in the back, shot him dead. So, and that just shows that there's just like a lack of, our lives seem to lack value. And Black Lives Matter seems to be off the back of that, really, that, our lives matter too.
I mean, it feels, to sort of hear that story laid out like that, feels so alien to people living in the UK, I think, because we don't see the police with guns, so it's not commonplace. But it is commonplace in the States that the police kill people. Yeah. I mean, and if you take a step back from that sentence, police kill people, that is absolutely insane. I mean, there shouldn't be police killings, frankly. There shouldn't ever be police killings. There obviously will be in certain situations where other lives are at threat and someone needs to be subdued, and there's no other way of subduing them other than a lethal force, as the police perceive it. But it's terrifying how commonplace it is.
Yeah, I mean, people over here are dying as well. I mean, we're not innocent, and we're no angels. People over here are dying in police custody. Famously, Mark Duggan is another example of someone who, wasn't, for want of a better term, whiter than white. Mm-hmm. And, he got murdered. Smiley Culture, I'm not sure you'll have heard of, but some of your listeners will have. He had a few hits in the 80s. He was killed in his own home by the police over here. So it's just as bad over here, people getting stopped and searched as well. Tony Deed, I don't know if everyone who listens is a Patreon of the Fighting Cock, but he talked about how many times he got stopped by the police in his own car. So the police over here don't have guns, but it is pretty bad over here the way they treat black people.
Mm. Yeah, you're right. It's not just the United States problem, it is a UK problem as well. It's just the fact that the UK police don't carry guns, so it's probably less frequent, but it doesn't make it any less institutionalized.
No, of course. Another trope that's kind of come about is you know, why are people protesting over here for? The police aren't murdering people. You know, it's nothing to do with black people over here. But the problems that are faced in America are faced worldwide, whether it be a bigger scale or a smaller scale. People in France, I think Serge Aurier put out a post on his Instagram about a black person who was, I believe, was killed by the police. I might have that wrong. Someone probably corrects me on that one. So there's issues in every major country, really.
I mean, why are the police killing people, frankly? But let's talk about your optimism for the movement, because you kind of hinted at that. Do you feel like this is a chance for some real change to happen? And how do you feel about, I mean, in terms of optimism, do you feel like there's a real possibility of actual genuine change?
I think the change will be at glacier pace. It'll be very slow. But I do feel a lot of people are waking up, not just black people, but white people. And you know, people are maybe not so much recognizing their privilege, but just realizing the microaggressions that they do day in, day out, that black people are almost gritting their teeth and getting on with it. They realize that, you know, that we are normal human beings. You know, I'm a big football fan. You know, it's not like you just have to talk to me about black things or speak to me like, I don't know, like I speak like troops from you know, Arsenal Fan TV. Mm. You know, and there are a lot of, you know, I see a difference. I think Instagram is probably the biggest one for it. I'm seeing a lot of people who wouldn't previously speak about race put out posts saying, you know, white people, you know, we've got to do better, calling each other out. And that's something I've never seen before. And that's where I see the change coming in. The curriculum, that's kind of gaining momentum. I think that's very, very important. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's a lot. I think something will change. There will be a legacy of all this that's going on at the moment. There will be some legacy. It may not be what I want. You know, everyone says racism's not going to end, but we all have our part to play. We all have our part to play.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there are going to be people who resist this, and that's natural. But the main thing is that I think the movement and the coverage of the movement will force organisations to make changes. And even if they're just doing it to pay lip service, they don't necessarily really care. They just want the positive PR. The knock-on effect of that will be that hopefully it will promote better messages and it will promote black people, frankly, in organisations. And it's interesting you mentioned the curriculum. I work in the education sector, and the idea of decolonising the curriculum is nothing new, but I think this will fast forward things. I think there'll be some major changes to the curriculum in schools and universities off the back of this, and that can only be a good thing. It's really important that young people have different voices and hear about different experiences and different cultures.
And then you mentioned about companies, and a lot of these companies, the upper echelons of the organizations don't represent their customer base.
Indeed.
And, you know, even Spurs tweeted out the Black Lives Matter thing a week or two ago. And I believe, I don't know if you did or someone else did, to say, well, what about your own staff? You know, where's the representation in your own staff? And that's important as well. If you have diversity within your teams, then the message will follow suit. And it's not about tokenism at all. There's nothing physically stopping a black person doing a job that a white person can do. And if you need to give them a leg up to get more representation to start with, then I don't see a problem with that at all.
Yeah, I agree. That is the common comeback at that, isn't it? It's, you know, we should be selecting the best people. It doesn't matter about race. But that's not strictly true, because we're only letting white people through the door in the first place. Something has to be done to correct that before we can then start selecting the quote unquote best people.
Well, yeah, I think that there are some people who do the All Lives Matter and that we're all on race, and you know, racism will go away if you don't talk about it. I just think that the only way, I think with this, is going to be some very difficult conversations that are going to be had, you know, with a lot of groups of friends. There are some people who for years and years have taken the microaggressions just to roll, you know, just banter in it. But I think the events of the last 2 weeks will make a lot of people think, you know, I haven't really got to take this anymore. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, there are plenty of, I mean, I've got plenty of white friends who are having difficult conversations with their other friends. And look, you know, you guys constantly say this and do this and it's not right. And they're not getting anywhere. But I would just say you can't necessarily give up on people. Everything's going to be a catalyst. And this can be a catalyst for many. But, you know, white people really do have to play their part.
Mm, absolutely. See, this is a football podcast, obviously. So I wanted to talk to you about your experiences of going to Spurs and whether you've witnessed racism at Spurs and whether you feel welcome at football as a black person.
I've experienced racism at Spurs, not to me though, but I've experienced people saying a couple of suspect things. I think the one I said on the Fighting Cock was someone called Drogba, a wog, and I eyeballed him. He apologised. I didn't accept the apology. This was probably about, well, it'd be about 2012, 2013. But my experiences at Spurs, I do feel generally welcome, by and large. At home games, it's fairly straight. It's not difficult at home games. When you go to the away games, you've got a smaller group. And I guess the elements that are a bit racist, they're a bit more visible when you go to away games. But I don't believe the racist fans of Spurs are mobilised in a way where it's like Combat 18 with Chelsea and, I don't know, what the fuck's West Ham, ICF, you know, a lot of racism within the ICF or Millwall fans. I don't think it's on that level, but there's racists in society and there's racists among our fans. I guess what would be a good thing to talk about would be the Rudiger situation. I wasn't in the country. I wasn't at the game. And, you know, I felt a bit sad about it. I mean, I think a lot of Spurs fans gave Rudiger grief because they thought he was lying. And the report came out and it was inconclusive. And he still got grief after that. So, you know, it did make me a bit sad. But, you know, I mean, how did you feel about the Rudiger situation? Did you come in for any stick?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I mean, I called it out for what I saw it to be at the time. And I still believe it happened. I think, you know, obviously Spurs did an investigation and they claimed they went through the crowd and using all the video footage they had, trying to identify a potential perpetrator. And I'm sure, I do believe that they did that. Like, I don't have reason to doubt that they would have genuinely really tried to do that. But just because they didn't find someone doesn't mean it didn't happen. And it's just, like you said, it's sad that Rudiger heard what he heard, or if he didn't hear what he heard, then the fact that he expected to hear it is sad. And it's a really difficult conversation to have because everyone's obviously defensive of their club because right-minded Spurs fans don't want Spurs to be a racist club. The idea of that happening at their club appalls them. And so, of course, they'll defend the club to the hilt. But like you say, there's problems in society, so naturally there are problems within football stadiums as well.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that was quite sad. And then the Spurs fans saying, we're not that kind of club, we're not that kind of club. But I think you need to kind of take those glasses off. It's not about being that kind of club. There are, what, there's 62,000-seater stadium. There's going to be racists in there. I don't believe it was a group of 5,000 fans calling him the N-word or doing monkey chants at him. There's every chance he might have heard one voice out of that entire crowd.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to go back to the initial question, I've always felt welcome at Spurs, not had any issues at all. But, you know, there are people I know to be a bit racist or have views that, you know, aren't compatible with mine when it comes to race. But as I said, it's societal. It's not something I would put at Spurs' door. And it probably is a bit naive. And, you know, when you get a lot of friends who support Spurs, the only thing you have in common is Spurs. And sometimes other things come to the surface, you know, so you don't like the same music or the same clothes or the same sort of books or anything. But, you know, I've had a couple of conversations where I've had to call people out, even within the last few weeks with the George Floyd stuff, you know, people saying, why are we fighting over here for? You know, it's not our problem. But there's been pretty much silence when after yesterday's riots, for example.
So
it is a bit difficult, but all in all, my experiences supporting Spurs have been largely positive, and I don't feel like I'm the odd one out when I go to games at home. Away, I don't feel the odd one out. I just get on with it and drink with everyone else. And, you know, I think our crowd's getting a bit more diverse, more so over the last 2-3 years than prior to that. And you know, given the area of Spurs, it's a diverse area anyway. So, yeah, I've never felt out of place at a Spurs game.
Well, that's really reassuring to hear that, to be honest, T. It makes me feel happy that is the case. That's not to say that football isn't institutionally racist, though. Do you think there's a problem in football?
Yeah, I do. And it's like what we said about companies previously, in that, you know, it's just a whole bunch of grey-haired, you know, elderly white men, you know, in grey suits behind the scenes making the decisions. And the decisions kind of bear that out that they're making, really. You do need to have diversity at all levels in this, and it's not there. And the decisions that have been made with managers and how they're treated. I mean, some of these black managers are not even getting interviews, which, you know, is laughable, really. Mm. The amount of black players, I mean, I'm speaking about the UK, really. The amount of black players have had, you know, over the last 30, 40 years to have maybe less than 10, of all the 92 professional clubs in England is a disgrace. You know, and, I guess the clap back to that is Sol Campbell. The comment he made saying, you know, why hasn't he got the top jobs? You know, I'm Sol Campbell, I should be getting the top jobs. But, you know, Sol Campbell's a difficult one because as a Spurs fan, I hate him. But as a black man, I empathise with some of the things that he says. And, you know, recent comments from Raheem Sterling, I don't know if you've heard those, about Lampard and Gerrard going straight into top jobs.
Yep.
And Ashley Cole, who's had as illustrious a career as the other two have, is just a backroom and the backroom staff at Derby.
Yeah.
You know, is that down to race in its, that situation in and of itself? I don't know. But, you know, there are certain people who are getting handed top jobs and other people not so.
But also, T, what's the, I mean, yes, it might be down to race and no, it might not be down to race, but what's the worst that can happen if we say, yes, it is down to race, so let's do something about it? You know, this is the kind of argument that I have with people. Why are we so desperate to say that it's not down to race? Why don't we just say it is down to race and try and fix the problem, even if it's not there, you know?
That's where the kind of mental health kind of comes into it, where you do feel like you're being a dick as a book, well, you almost question yourself. It's almost like I want to say, oh, maybe it's not about race, maybe it's not, when, you know, in my heart of hearts, it probably is.
Of course it is. I mean, you said it yourself, all these black footballers we've had over the last two decades, you know, many of the best footballers in our country are black, and how many of them are now coaches and managers?
Well, the...
you look in the boardrooms as well, and you look at the referees even, you know, since Uri Rennie retired, we've not had a black referee.
Yeah, it's shocking, and it's not, as I said, football is a meritocracy. If a manager is shit, he'll get the sack. So if Mourinho got the sack and, I don't know, for argument's sake, Les Ferdinand got the job, if he does shit, he gets the sack.
Yeah.
What's there to lose? You know, and that's what it is. It's not like they're going to keep him there. The Spurs get relegated to League Two because he's black. He's going to keep his job. That won't work. It couldn't
exactly.
work.
Exactly.
Why not give these guys a chance? You get people like Chris Powell, who, you know, doesn't have a lot to really say for himself. And he's a shining beacon, you know. He keeps getting decent jobs, but maybe he could have stepped up by now. What's the other guy's name? Forgotten. Chris Hughton's another one, you know. And people say, well, you know, he's doing all right. You know, he's doing all right. He should be thankful. I'm like, well, he should be the exception. Chris Hughton retired from top-level football circa 30 years ago. He's 60 now, you know. He's not got that long left at the top. And you've got Chris Powell, who's probably in his 50s, I think, maybe. So it's just so few and far between. And something's got to change. And, you know, the Rooney rule is much derided, but it's getting to a point where something that strong needs to happen.
So explain what the Rooney rule is.
I think it's where you have to, if you're interviewing 12 people, at least one of them has to be a BAME. Not a big fan of that term, but yeah, that's what you need.
Okay.
So you have to at least interview them. And if you're interviewing 12 people, none of them are minorities, then yeah, I guess even if it is tokenism and they show they can do the job, maybe say, you know, you're not going to get this job, but I'll give you a job at this place, then the numbers will increase.
It's difficult in top flight football because so often we see a manager lose his job and then the next man is already lined up anyway. Like, Mourinho is announced so quickly that there can barely have been an interview process, can there? So that adds another a blockage in the way, I guess, as well.
No, exactly. And I think he even mentioned, I mean, this is kind of going a little bit off topic, but even if like podcasts, for example, you know, you want to, I mean, it'd be good to diversify, but you still want to do that on merit, but then you've got to give people the chance. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what can we do? I mean, but I think football has to represent what's on the pitch, what's in the crowds, and the crowds are getting more and more diverse. You know, much as I hate Arsenal, you know, their crowd's very, very diverse. And I think in the next 10, 15 years, Spurs will be too, now that we're getting better, I think, you know, we'll see more minority fans at our games.
Do you have ideas, T? I mean, you mentioned the Rooney Rule, but do you have any ideas for how we can support the eradication of racism in football?
Oh, That's a very, very
it's a big question.
Question.
It's a big question. And obviously, you know, Troy Townsend, who is someone we both know and admire greatly, he's doing wonderful work. But I think Troy sometimes feels like he's just banging his head against the brick wall because he makes the same suggestions over and over again, and it feels like he doesn't get listened to.
Well, yeah, I mean, these are what I'd probably say would be stuff he suggested already. But you've got to take it seriously when players are racially abused. It has to. I mean, people are getting paltry fines. You know, what comes up over and over again is Nicholas Bentner getting fined more than some nations' FAs are being done for racism. So, you know, why not put heavier sanctions on them? You know, if fans are caught to be racially abused, using people, you know, also that's got to be heavier sanctions as well. And there was a Leeds player who called someone the N-word.
Yeah.
I believe he got a few months. Don't know if it's suspended for a few months. I'm not sure what the sanction was. But it's just got to be stronger sanctions from that point of view. It just has to be because, well, if I'm racially abused as a footballer, and I know that they're only going to get a 2-3 game ban, what's the point of me even turning it in?
Yeah.
And Rudiger will feel the same way. I mean, look, I don't know if he ever, it could have been who let the Yids out or Yids or whatever. But if he's done that, if he's believes he's heard racial abuse and nothing happens, how's he going to feel? How are other black people going to feel? Why would they come forward? He's getting dogs abuse on social media, which comes with being a footballer anyway, because he was brave enough to come forward. Why should anyone else come forward? And it's the same with the managers. You know, I mean, the next generation of black top-level footballers would be wealthy beyond their dreams. So why would they bother going to management? But then they'll think, well, what have I got to aspire to? You know, Chris Hughton managing mid-table teams and Chris Powell knocking around the lower leagues. Why bother? So it has to be stronger sanctions, and I think there has to be a bigger effort to diversify football at boardroom level. Les Ferdinand, I believe, was at a fairly high level at QPR, and hopefully that will be more commonplace.
Absolutely. And you referenced there the Leeds player. It was their goalkeeper, Kassia.
Yeah.
And he abused Jonathan Lecco of Charlton. He was given an 8-game ban and a £60,000 fine. I mean, it's nothing, really, is it? It's hardly a deterrent when a player's getting an 8-game ban for using a racial slur.
Exactly. It's a disgrace. It's just like, well, no, this is another thing. If that was a Spurs player who got the eight-game ban, and I'm at Beaver Town and I'm saying it's a disgrace, and other fans would be like, well, he's a bit of an idiot, isn't he? It is what it is. So I don't push the argument. There's not really worth me pushing the argument forward and ruining everyone's day. So, you know, I just got to kind of eat shit, really.
Speaking of that, T, how do you feel about Dele Alli's punishment? He's 1-game ban.
Oh, man. I'm conflicted because you thought it was going to be a bigger ban.
I did.
I guess it's not a deterrent at all. As such, it was meant to be a private message and it was out publicly.
I feel like he kind of got off on a technicality because he said the guy was coughing, but you couldn't hear it in the video.
Yeah, it's a difficult one because I don't want to downplay what East Asian people go through. I don't know many East Asian people, so I don't have any first-hand accounts of, you know, of what they go through living in the UK. But yeah, I do think even if I don't believe he should have got a bigger ban than what he got, I think there has to be a deterrent out there. It has to be a deterrent because he's getting that came out and he knows he's not going to get a long ban. So he just says sorry and gets on with it. I mean, look at the Wayne Hennessy situation as well, you know?
There's
just got to be more deterrence. And, you know, what Dele Alli did was wrong and should have probably got a longer ban based on what he did.
Let's end this on a positive and a kind of developmental point. How can people be allies?
First thing is to listen. If a black person or the minority says something is racist, it probably is, and they'll know better than you. You know, there's times when you get told, oh, it's just banter and all that. But if they say it's racist, take it seriously. You know, I think Renia Lodge's at number one of her book. So books like that are very helpful. And just, yeah, this week you just got to listen to the pleas of, you know, black people, Asian people and other minority groups, because I'm not saying something is racist for a laugh. You know what I mean? It's not about me not being able to take a joke. I can clearly take a joke being part of the Fighting Cock podcast. But, you know, if I say something is racist, 99.9999% of the chance it probably is. And you just got to listen. And just call out other white people. Call it out. Don't be afraid to call them out. There's going to be people of friendship groups who are going to be split. You know, there are going to be people who feel like all lives matter and everything Black Lives Matter. Don't be afraid to challenge them on it. But at the same token, you know, if you're not a confrontational person, don't beat yourself up about it. Just try and educate yourself more. Just try and slowly educate people around you, whether it be about privilege or intersectionality. And it's not just about race. It's about sexualities and gender and all of that. You just really got to just listen to people. I'm not going to go into the nuts and bolts of what J.K. Rowling has said, but she has a platform, and those comments can be seen as damaging to a lot of people who are struggling. There's a lot of deaths of particularly Black trans people, and they're not heavily reported on. So everyone has to be mindful of the impact that these opinions can have. Everyone's entitled to an opinion, but everyone's entitled to free speech. But you have to be mindful of the impact of what you're saying.
T, you're a wonderful man. Thank you so much for your time. And next time, you will be here talking about football.
Yeah,
not about these issues.
No problem, man. Anytime.
Take care of yourself, mate.
Okay, mate. Bye.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, everybody. I am joined by my friend, Seif. Seif is a Man United fan, but more importantly for what we're going to talk about today, he is American and he is Black. But let's warm up. Let's talk about football. So United Spurs is coming up with the return to Premier League football. How are you feeling about that match?
I'm just excited to see the gang back in action. You know, I just want to see Rashi out there, see Poe swing and play with Bruno. As much as I'm not a huge Ole fan, I'm not a big Ole Gunnar Solskjaer fan, still want to see the boys play, you know?
I saw clips from United's training match or whatever surfacing around recently, and United fans getting excited about various individual players. I guess that's also happening within the Spurs fan base. I think there was a Lamella goal that people were excited by, but I don't know, I'm still feeling kind of weird about it, but hopefully once the actual match kicks in, it'll feel real and good again.
Yeah, it still feels kind of like almost a dirtiness to it to be excited about these people having to go back to work. But it is a good, you know, it'll be fun to have the games back on. It'll be fun to actually be able to dive into that for an hour and a half, 2 hours on a weekend, yeah. You know,
and a reason to stay in. So there's that. Right. So this is an episode about racism in football, or at least predominantly about racism in football. And Windy's going to have, in the meantime, conducted a couple of interviews on those topics. But I think that this one is going to be a little more broad. So every time there is a racism incident, to use like horrifically journalistic language, John Barnes gets called up by Sky, and then he gets called up by the BBC, and every time he says the same thing. He says that racism is not a football issue, it's a society issue, and that racism within football won't be solved until racism within society is solved. Do you agree with him on that?
Yeah, I mean, I actually do kind of agree with that. Is, you know, football exists in we live in a society, you know, like people say, like it's...
we do live in a society.
So there's no way to divorce football from that. Like it permeates every interaction, just because it colors how people grow up, how people experience things. It, you know, I got in a big discussion the other day with like my girlfriend about how a lot of things that we consider intrinsic, like basically everything is learned. And
sure,
it's a thing that it's learned. You experience it from the first day and it colors every single thing. So football will not be immune to that.
So with that in mind, let's discuss sort of current events. I guess the sort of the foundational question, and it's a very uncomfortable one, but I guess it sort of gives us a launch pad here is, generally speaking, why do you think George Floyd was killed?
Generally speaking, it's a crisis of over-policing, generally. It's hard for me to gear down too specifically on the George Floyd incident, because it is, you know, a long time coming. There are a lot of things that built into that interaction. Part of the reason why even a police officer would find it okay to approach a citizen in that manner and carry out actions in that way is that in America specifically, our police are very, very, very rarely held accountable for uses of force. If you have, like, you know, a fear of actual consequence for your actions, you behave in a slightly different way. And it's almost been a learned behavior over time that as a cop, your job is to protect order, protect capital, and you do that by cracking down on, like, these disparate classes, and you're not going to be punished for it because that's what you're supposed to do. And, like, that's how you end up in that scenario where I believe it was that the owner of the store ended up calling the cops, and then the cops come and they escalate because that's what they do, and because they feel that they have the power in every scenario, they never stop to think, and it goes from there.
So do you think that sort of consequences of actions is the major focus of the ongoing process? Is that the sort of overriding theme?
I think that's what people are finally starting to, I think there's good to harping on that, and there's also some not good to it. It is a problem that there is not consequence for the action of the police. It's good that people are focusing on, like, hey, if police are allowed to do whatever, they will do whatever, and that will lead to an abuse of power. I think it's good that people are looking at it in that way. But the issue generally is, like, over-policing, and it is much more systemic than that. In the U.S. especially, the police are asked to do, like, way too much. In America, we call the police to get a cat out of a tree. You see a dog running loose, you call the police. You have a neighbor going through mental health crisis, you call the police. Wow. You have, like, your friend who you usually talk to every day, like, for some reason you think, oh no, I haven't heard from them in 2 days. I tried to call them and they're not answering, and I can't swing by their place. Like, let me call, even if you call 911, which is our line to emergency services, and you say you want to have a wellness check on your friend that you haven't heard from in a while, they will still send the police there sometimes without any EMS. So, like, the police is so deeply ingrained in our heart. And that over-policing leads to just so many interactions with the police where it's become this monolith that does so much. And now that they do so much and there's never any consequences for it, they overstep consistently.
That's interesting. I mean, I'm very reluctant to do the thing where it's like, wow, those Americans sure have it bad with racism. It's a good job that we're fine with everything and there's no police issues here in the UK, because obviously that's, like, an absurd stance. But you've definitely opened my eyes there to, like, how much the police are just involved in everything, because I've never called the police in my life. I think my parents have called the police once or twice, and based on their own experience with that, have sort of vowed off that unless they felt it was an absolute necessity. But, like, definitely, you know, they are not the resource I go to for several of the examples you gave there, or that we go to for several of the examples you gave there. So that's very interesting. That do you think it's a simple case that the greater the police involvement with various aspects of society, the worse their behavior and the worse the situation is?
I don't know if it's necessarily that because there's so much involvement, it makes it worse. But the fact that there's so much involvement and there's also a, like, racial bias to it makes it more likely to end up negatively impacting a certain, like, sect of society. And that's kind of where I'm coming at it from. I think it would be, like, an idealized world if, you know, your cat was stuck in a tree, every person can call their community animal services people or whatever.
Sure.
And if, you know, your neighbor was having a mental health episode, you'd be able to actually call your community's, like, mental health services, where they would come in and be able to check on them, de-escalate, and be trained. That would be ideal, but it's hard to, like, button down, because policing in the U.S. has such a troubled, like, history, especially, and there's so many things that go into it. There's so many things about how the excesses of our, like, military-industrial complex have led to this bill that basically allows police to get like military equipment for free, and like our cops just have like drones and tanks, and you've seen them in like full riot gear. And then that also militarizes the mindset of the police to a point where they think of themselves as occupying forces, especially in minority communities, or especially in poor communities. So I really don't want to like make it as if this is solely a race issue. Especially in the US, like the police come from a history of like slave catching, one, but that's not only a racial issue, that is an issue of protecting like the property of the capital owning class. And like, not to go, you know, full Marxist or anti-capitalist or anything like that, but like they very much do protect the interests of the rich, and primarily the rich white people, and that leads to disparate impacts against black people and brown people, but also against even poor white people who feel the wrath of those militarized police. And I completely like lost the plot in there, because there's so many avenues to go down. Like when you talk about policing, it's honestly like that's kind of why the abolition movement and the conversation around it has, you've seen it spurn and split off into 80 different conversations, because there's so many ways where it touches people and so many ways where it could be improved, that it's hard to button down on one. It's hard to button down on one root cause. Is it the fact that it's like has rotten roots in slave catching and punishing like even white farmers for not working hard enough on their fields like back in the day? Is it that they've been militarized? Is it that like the cops don't live in the communities that they police? Is it that there's a general race problem in the United States, you know, stemming from chattel slavery? Like there's so many things to possibly attribute it to that it's hard to pick one. And probably the answer is that it's all of the above. But that's kind of hard to wrap your head around too.
Sure. I think the history of policing, specifically within America, but globally as well, is really interesting, because I think that we like to discuss police as this sort of like necessity and this sort of conceptually pure thing that is just sort of fundamental to an ordered society. But when you look and then like, oh, how did our police force become racist? You know, that sort of white shock thing of, wow, how did this happen? But like, clearly conceptually, or at least from the off, police were designed around sort of racist ideas and as you say, possession protector of ideas. Do you think that like the concept of police at all is essentially just prone to racism, or just conceptually racist from the basis?
It's a funny thing, because like you touched on, police has almost been like retconned as like a thing that's always existed. It has to be this way. Before this, there was like madness, and every time you walked out, you were just being bludgeoned by the biggest guy in the street, and it was all primal and like awful. And like, it's not the case, one, for like a lot of the, you know, a lot of the world now, a lot of places that even have police, now you're seeing like other protests pop off about policing. It's fully like an export of colonialism. They exist in societies that didn't have policing and that were able to like still self-organize.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like put in place by colonialist nations to protect the like property and interest of those like colonizers. And when you think about it in that like context, where a lot of police forces came in with like war and colonization to protect the interest of the colonizers, like of course it always ends up in a place where it's racialized. You know, it's of course it always ends up in a place where like in Brazil, like Afro-Brazilians are policed more just strictly violently than white Brazilians. Of course it ends up in the ways where it's, you know, black and brown people are policed far more violently than like white people in the United States. Of course it ends up in a way where like minority, marginalized, you know, surplus populations are more policed wherever you go. It almost is fundamentally like the creation of the police to protect private property and the interest of those who own property, and the value of that property will always lead to, you know, it has to be almost a violent subjugation of the people who don't own property, the people who aren't part of the dominant class. And that often is expressed through like just racism, because it's oftentimes the most clearest line to tell who is or isn't in the in-group, you know?
Given that, then, is sort of, is racism inevitable wherever there is economic inequality?
There's it's not inevitable. I wouldn't say that. It's just that it's the easiest
means of division.
Exactly. The easiest avenue by which to separate the interests of people who otherwise might be against like a ownership or dominant class, you know, is if you could create division along these very clear, like actually visible lines. If you can create division there, it prevents people actually turning and looking in one direction and possibly, you know, revolting, insurrection, this, that, and the third. And it's more just an issue of like where there's equality, the police will serve to protect the people at the very top, and the people at the very top will also work to sow racism because it keeps the people who are suffering underneath the police, and because they're not at the very top, from actually being mad at the people at the top, if that makes sense.
It does. So we've touched on sort of some of the ways in which police can be sort of cut back, especially in American society, but again, I also think globally we can still do a better job here of not utilizing the police for, you know, every minor issue. So there's grounds for I guess what still comes under reform there, but you also touched on abolition. Do you think that there are solutions within the police abolition movement?
I think, like, very fundamentally, you like, again, I'm not a person who studied on this for years. Like, I've touched upon pieces about abolition a lot from Twitter, where I've actually come across these conversations. But, like, I struggle to see a path to full abolition of, like, policing, while there is still, like, conceptually, you know, private property and needs that need to be protected. Because, like, my, you know, the worst part is, I mean, the fear that I have almost is if you just outright abolish police today, is that the role of policing would then just be taken up by, like, Blackwater
private security
groups like that, because the interest is still there. I think, like, the way that I see it maybe working out best is the defund movement in a path towards abolition, where we're defunding the police and actually supporting community solutions, where I think there are some reforms that can be pushed to make policing less brutal, less violent, make people more accountable to the communities that they police by, one, making them live there, but also actually, like, if you do a bad thing, realistically, if, like, the police are the order, the people we're supposed to hold and create order for a society, like, you should actually hold them to the highest standard of all. Like, that would just, in my mind, that would just make the most sense. They should be the most exemplary, so when they do misstep, like, have a misstep, they should be the heaviest critique.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah, if you actually impose that, like, that would go a long way. If you make people actually live in the communities which they police, that would go a long way. If you take away a lot of the money that goes to police, that leads to efforts that lead to, again, militarization of the police, and you actually fund those, like, community animal services, like, hotline, and the community, like, mental health hotline, and if you create a class of unarmed civilian group that is trained de-escalators and can respond to incidents of, you know, domestic violence or child endangerment, that's not the police. If you could have, just, it has to be like radically rethought, and I struggle to see what the path forward is, because there's just so much, like, there's so much built up around the absolute need for them, and there's such a pushback against any type of questioning of the way that they move. But I think that, like, if you start with defunding police, and if you move towards supporting community solutions to issues that people have, community solutions that also, like, create room for rehabilitation and, like, actual restorative justice, and you just limit how often the police get called, I think if you can move towards that, people will slowly start to realize that they don't need the police as much as they thought, and then you could actually be on a path to potential for abolition.
Okay. Can you talk to me briefly a little bit about restorative justice and what that means?
It's a term that's kind of hard to even, like, wrap my head around, because it's something that I've only really started to actually dive into. But it's, you know, it's almost like making people whole again, people that were harmed, and the people who did the harming, approaching them as, like, humans and trying to find solutions that can help the people who are harmed, but also make it so the people that are doing the harm aren't in a position to do it again. Like, getting to the root of issues, to actually figuring out how do we resolve this in a way that works for both parties and makes it so that this doesn't happen again. And it's, like, sounds pie in the sky in a way, but I think it's something that can be achieved. It's just going to take, like, more compassion, more understanding, more community, and a lot more want to. And like, I really hope that people can get on a path towards that.
It makes a lot of sense to me because, like, I think if you think about like what is prison and what is it for, if you start with the idea that like it's a place to put people who are too dangerous for society, I sort of have to accept that's maybe a necessity. But then from there, it obviously continues to grow and it becomes this idea of like a means of reforming people. But it's obviously clearly not performing that purpose because people who go to prison tend to go back to prison, and it doesn't work as a deterrent because there are so many crimes committed or invented up even. Yeah, I definitely think that obviously makes sense. I just think that this is there's a lot of like brands and individuals who sort of use the phrase systemic racism at the moment. They want to acknowledge and address systemic racism, but then there's very little conversation, at least in my circles, and probably this is a failure of myself, but there seems to be very little discussion of what are the systems of racism and how are they built and where does it exist. So now that we've sort of understood sort of the role briefly here, obviously, of policing, of property, of prisons in terms of systemic racism, those obviously aren't the limits. So once we've, you know, now that we've completely solved police and prisons perfectly forever, where else do we address systemic racism?
In education, in just access to services, in transportation, in creating, like, again, public spaces for people to actually be community and like not be atomized like that. It's all, people say systemic racism, they don't talk about like the system under which racism thrives, and like one of those systems is the system of, you know, is the system of capitalism, where it calls for an atomization, it calls for a separation, it creates a need for a divide, and it creates a need for an exploited class, and it creates a need for a subjugation. If the only means by which to like derive profit is through the exploitation of someone else's labor, you're always going to have something, someone that needs to be doing worse off. And like, how do we make it so that there's not that? Or how do it, you know, even if we're not going to full like communization or anything, how do we reduce those ills? How do we make it so the people who are worse off aren't so bad off, at least as a start? And then like, that is when you will be able to tackle the system of systemic racism, is when you could tackle the systems that lead to this inequality, lead to this inequity, lead to this diversity in outcomes and opportunities. Like that's kind of where it starts.
Okay. So I know that, like, specifically feminism, but also within other courses as well, there's a lot of talk about a glass ceiling. Is it, for you, is it more about raising the floor than looking to the top?
Yeah, I mean, because raising the floor helps a lot more people than getting a couple more people to the top. And if we were just a society where the absolute floor was still like 3 square meals a day and a roof over your head,
yeah,
we'd be way better off than if we had a couple more black, brown, trans, queer, like billionaires at the top.
Sure, that makes sense to me. Is there anything else to talk about? Is there anything you want to talk about?
Nothing that comes to mind. Like I could ramble on, and I have to my family members and all my friends in the past, for hours and go down like twisted paths and create wild analogies and all this stuff. But like the biggest thing is I think I want to call attention to again is that policing isn't only an issue of race. It is also an issue of class. And you need to like actually keep that conversation in the front of your mind as well. You need to be able to actually critique it from there. You can't talk about systemic racism. You can't talk about intersectionality of, again, gender and race without mentioning class. Because I said it on my Instagram to a couple of my, you know, my lib friends. It's like, in a world where we were able to make police outcomes completely flat on the system of race, you would still have a system of policing in which queer people were targeted more, in which poor people were targeted more, and like that's not acceptable either. So like, keep that in your mind, keep that in the lens when you consider this issue of policing and how we can improve it going forward.
Brilliant, thank you for coming on Cephas. I really appreciate this.
No problem, my pleasure, thank you for having me.
Peace, dude.
All right.
You've been listening to The Extra Inch. Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Barney for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindner for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter at @DavyShambles and SoundCloud @DLindner. Do check him out, he's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really help.